your prime.
What about my prime, Nick?
Welcome to Properly Howard, a podcast that reviews classic films and other pulp fiction. Today we take a look at Paul Thomas Anderson's Punch Drunk Love, starring Adam Sandler as an antisocial, somewhat disturbed plunger salesman who inexplicably falls in love. So essentially Waterboy without the football. With me, as always, is Dr. Anthony LaDon.
Love it. I guess Paul Thomas Anderson saw the movie Big Daddy and loved that film so much that he decided he wanted to write a movie for Adam Sandler. When was the last time you saw Big Daddy?
I've only seen it once, and it must have been when it like had kind of come out.
Would it be great if there was like a drug you could take? It was like a PTA drug. And you pop this pill, and now you're going to be able to watch Big Daddy and see what Paul Thomas Anderson sees in Big Daddy.
Steve, I've spent a lot of my 20s listening to sports talk radio. I don't know if you've tried it recently.
Oh, yeah. I listen to it. It's
insufferable.
Oh, boy. Yeah, it is. It's really hard.
It's very difficult. Like, I just used to have KMBR on 24/7. You know, if I wasn't listening to music, I'd be listening to sports talk, which meant I was listening to a lot of commercials.
Right.
You know, I don't know how much of it was actually sports. How much of it was like performance art and the daily jingles that gave my life a meaning?
Right. Cars for kids,
beauty store and more, you know, just tons of stuff. And it's been a long time, you know, now that there are podcasts and now that my interests are sort of wider and deeper than sports, I have not listened to sports talk for a long time. But, you know, the Giants are interesting this year, so I started listening to a few of the old programs. Mm. It's horrible. It's just, it makes you want to tear your eyes out. It's so bad.
Yeah. Yeah, I kind of hate listen to it. Like, I'll listen to it, but I'm like...
Right, there's the hate listen aspect, right?
Which is a very fascinating thing to do, right? I mean, it's a really odd choice that we put ourselves through. Like, ooh, boy, I'm not going to want to like this. Like, you don't do that with anything else. You don't, like, hate eat, do you? And, like, eat something that you just, oh, man, I can't stand the taste of this. Well, this milk has turned. Oh, I'm going to make some cereal.
It's kind of crazy to me how much it was a part of my life. And it's not like I loved it back then. Half the time I was thinking, these guys don't know what they're talking about. And I would just sit there and be angry listening to these morons. And that was probably part of it. You know, they were like, look, it doesn't matter whether they love you or hate you. Just get the listeners.
Exactly.
Because we know that there's 30% of the people out there that just hate listen. And that's fine for us.
Yeah, totally.
Because we need a certain number to sell our Cars for Kids ads, which is, again, a hateful commercial.
Right.
Just
like,
horrible.
I've lost sight of like the good that charity might be doing for kids, because I just now just don't like, I don't like cars or kids now. Running or not, in most cases.
So, I want to play this scene from Punch Drunk Love.
I was listening to these morning DJs this morning, and they always have couples that call in and and talk about their problems. And this DJ Justice, this morning DJ that I really like, and they were talking about pictures, and they were talking about yearbook pictures and how nobody's happy with the way they look in their pictures. And I just love this guy because he tells it the way it is. He's not a phony. And this guy calls up and he's talking about his senior quote. And so DJ Justice says, what was your senior quote? What was so great about it? He says, I stole an ancient proverb. And right. So he says, okay. And he says, confusion say. And then DJ Justice says, confusion or Confucius. And it was just so comical. But DJ Justice just cuts you down to size, you know? And that's my favorite part of the show. I laugh. I laugh and laugh, even when I'm alone.
It's such a sad and lonely quote. I think about that scene probably once a week.
That's awesome.
I think about that scene about once a week for the last 15 years of my life. I think it's a masculinity thing. I think that there's something about the beta male wanting an alpha male in their life. Where are you going to get it? Well, these blowhards on the radio, they seem to have it all together. And you
just say it like it is.
They say, and they cut you down to size, and you just love it. And it's like, what the hell is this? What is this about? Why are people so weird? Why are men so fucking weird? All right, so there's sort of the awkward date quality to that scene, right?
Right.
She, you know, is she really lad? Does she really think it's funny? Because the joke is horrible.
Right.
But that's what you do at a date. You laugh. It's sort of like, this is a little fiction that we both agreed upon.
Yeah, we're gonna do our best to enjoy this, and then we'll look back at it later, and then we'll like kind of debrief in our minds.
Yes,
this is. But in this moment, you know, it's like it's cosplay.
It's cosplay, and here we have Barry Egan. He desperately wants to appear normal,
right?
And he'll lie. Like he lies a lot in this movie. He'll just lie because all he wants is for just people to look at him and say, that's a normal guy. And so he continues to try to act normal. And because of that, he's just deeply abnormal because he's trying too hard to be normal.
Yeah. Well, and he doesn't know what that is, right? Like he
doesn't know what it is.
He just doesn't know what it is. And, and I think he, you know, he even goes so far as to say that, right? I mean,
with Smigel.
Yeah, when he's with Smigel and he's just kind of like, he's like, well, I don't know how other people are.
He's like, I can get you the number for a psychiatrist, but what's the issue? Like, what's the matter? And he's like, I don't know if there is anything a matter because I don't know how other people are.
Right.
The world is a bizarre place where you don't know when it's okay to lie and when it's not okay to lie. You don't know when it's okay to perform and not okay to perform. There's so much of this movie where he's just like, okay, what would look normal in this moment? Because whatever I'm going to do, whatever my instinct is abnormal. So let me just try to do what I think someone else would do.
Yeah, the most honest I think he is in this movie ever is when he's threatening somebody. And when he says, I don't know, and he says, I don't know a lot. And that's an interesting moment because I think what he's saying is like, when they're like, well, are you going to do this? I don't know. And I don't think he knows. And it's like, I think the problem that he has is he's like, I can't go through life saying, I don't know to every single question.
I think he says, I don't know half the time because he thinks, what are the fewest number of words that I can say for this conversation to be over?
Well, what's this? I believe it's a small piano. That's not a piano. I've got a piano at home. Where'd you get it? It was dropped in the street. Why is it here, Barry? Barry? I don't know. Because, I mean, and that's the thing is, like, we kind of want, like, and when you're watching a movie, especially, like, if you're watching, like, a Paul Thomas Anderson movie, you kind of, like, you kind of want to see, like, well, what is it? Like, what does this represent? And I'm sure there's, I mean, then there is plenty of symbolic things, of things that are representative. But I think there are also things that are just, like, there is a degree of chaos and there's a things that just sort of pop up or happen. And it's like, well, yeah, I don't know. and maybe some things are not meant to be known.
So here's another scene where he's really honest with himself.
Okay. I'm going to go. Good to see you again. Good to see your face again. Mm-hmm. Go out with you.
I'm going to be around and back in town in a few days.
Oh,
but yes. If you come to Hawaii...
I don't know. We'll see about that. I don't know.
Okay, I'll call you when I get back.
Okay. Have a good trip. And bye-bye.
he leaves and he walks. He's walking away, talking to himself now.
And bye bye. And bye bye. You fucking. And bye bye, you stupid motherfucker.
It's so perfect. It's like you just had an exchange and you thought, did it go okay? So I'm going to rehearse it in my mind. Like, let me just replay it in my mind. No, that was horrible. That was the worst thing I could have said. And why did I say it with that voice? And then you start like that interior negative voice kicks in like, you stupid motherfucker.
Yeah.
It's such a great scene to show the difference between the voice that he thinks he needs to use in this social situation and his interior voice. They're completely different voices.
Well, and a movie like this, I think, works so well too that there's no like not to pick on Carlito's Way again, but like there's no voiceover.
Go ahead and kill me, you cocksucker.
Continue.
Which that character could have been in this movie and it would have been just fine. And you know, and it's like there's a couple of things about this that work really well, and why I think Adam Sandler is a very intriguing choice for this, because one, I think he does a great job, and I just love that this is like maybe the most likable any of his characters really ever are. In a movie that's not made to really make him the hero like all the other movies he's in. It's like because so much of the characters in like, you know, Billy Madison, Happy Gilmore, Waterboy and the like, he's an improbable hero or romantic lead somehow.
But he's also kind of like an adolescent who's not quite ready to be an adult.
But he is an adult. You know what I mean? That's the thing. In all of these movies, for the most part, he's an adult, and you don't like, and you go, oh yeah, well he's just like, yeah, you could say, oh, well, he's just not ready to grow up. It's like, yeah, but he is a grown up. So it's like, that's the part of it, right? So like, and if you just look at it as a comedy, you can say, okay, well that's kind of a funny, endearing quality. But if you were to put that in real life, you go, that's not funny nor endearing. If I knew this person in real life, I would suggest that there's something wrong with them, right? Or there's something off.
Yeah, someone came to the dinner party and they were like smiling the whole time and then they decided to kick three of your glass windows in out of nowhere. This is a person you don't invite to parties.
Well, and what I love about this is if you take this movie and you have it as a regular, you know, Happy Madison joint, that whole scene is funny. It's a funny scene to watch him lose it because they called him gay boy one more time and he just broke all the windows and you would be like, ah, man, that guy's crazy, man. You know, what if, you know, he's a powder keg and but that's his tackling fuel or that's what helps him be really good at this or whatever it is. But in this movie, it's like, oh, this is a character flaw. Very large character.
This is a deeply disturbed individual.
Exactly. And so it's really interesting how this movie could easily, in the hands of a different, you can remake this movie shot for shot almost with just a slight tweak of tone. And it is an Adam Sandler movie like you've seen any other Adam Sandler movie.
So, okay. This is something interesting to talk about. I think that if you are an Adam Sandler fan, like I remember I used to have a roommate who used to say, it's the least funny Adam Sandler movie. Okay, so then there's that, right? It's like this does not feel like Happy Gilmore. This does not feel like Billy Madison or Big Daddy or 50 First Dates. It just doesn't feel that way. If you were a Paul Thomas Anderson fan and you got in early and you were like, you know, you're a big fan of Boogie Nights or Magnolia or There Will Be Blood. This could be a very disappointing movie because this just doesn't feel like those other movies. So in a way, if you're a PTA fan, maybe this is a disappointment. And if you're an Adam Sandler fan, this might be a disappointment. But there's something about like the pickles and ice cream that kind of make it interesting.
Right.
I think it's an underappreciated movie for that reason. I feel like this is a brilliant, it's just a stroke of genius, this movie.
I agree. I love this movie. Like I and it's funny because even like last night, I said, "Hey Heather, do you want to watch this or do you want, you know, I'm gonna just go on my own?" She's like, "Oh, I'll give it a shot and then we'll see if I, you know, want to bow out."
Yeah.
And she was right back in and she was like, "Oh my gosh, I forget how much I really enjoy this movie." To me, maybe the most impressive feat is that it's so short.
Yeah.
Like it, and it covers so much emotional ground and it covers really interesting things. Like when you start breaking down like the different subplots and you go, that's an hour and 35 minutes. And I never feel like I got short shrift on any of them.
That's right.
And again, I think we've talked about this maybe even on this podcast, but we've talked about the idea that Paul Thomas Anderson's a big, he loves watching Adam Sandler movies. And so he gets to make one. And part of me believes that he thinks he's making a comedy just like all the other ones he watches, but he watches them through a Paul Thomas Anderson lens. Cause like he has a very unique eye and a very unique perspective.
He can't help himself, but be Paul Thomas Anderson.
Right. So the question I have, and I would love to sit and ask Paul Thomas Anderson this, do you think you made a Billy Madison movie?
Right.
And then the question from that is, if you were to say yes, go, what do you see when you watch those movies? Because for all we know, he's watching Waterboy and he's just like, what a tragic tale. You know? I mean, I don't know. I would love to know. Right. And like, or like to your point, he's like, oh, I'm going to make something really fun and whimsical. And that's the best he could do. And all of his movies up until this point were supposed to be whimsical comedies. He just has a very odd sense.
I mean, look, if you look at where There Will Be Blood.
He's like, how come more people didn't think The Master was hilarious?
No, that's kind of true, though. I mean, if you return to There Will Be Blood, you know, it's genius. It's a great acting performance. It's tragic. But if you watch it like on your fourth time, Daniel Plainview is kind of hilarious.
Yes.
Like, I would agree. Like he's legitimately funny to watch. And on some other level that I didn't know existed when I first watched it. This movie's kind of similar. I feel like the first time I watched it, I've got this really horrible habit of bringing Sarah to movies on our anniversary and Valentine's Day that are just the worst. The worst vibe movies ever. Like I think
I got us a hotel room and some champagne. It's on ice. Let's just finish Amistad.
That's kind of it. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I we saw Fight Club. I mean, there was a lot of movies that as a young man I just didn't know, like, you know, why not just see a good movie together? Why does
so
it
you're Travis to... Bickle.
Yeah, like why didn't this is the movie that I would go to? Like why wouldn't she? Anyway, we went to see this movie, and I remember walking out like feeling like tight, like my shoulders were tight, and I just thought I'd never been so anxious in a movie in my life, and I think for that reason, it might have been 10 years before I came back to it.
Oh, wow.
But then when I did, I was like, oh my gosh, like the second watch, the third watch, this gets really funny in a lot of places that I did not laugh the first time. So it really is rewarding upon rewatch. I think partly because, and we were talking about the score in No Country for Old Men, partly because the music in this movie, is so emotionally affecting.
Oh yeah,
it's like it's a character.
I was just gonna say that same thing. I mean, the music. I mean, it's like our emotions are the instruments, and the music itself is the conductor.
So it's interesting, like, you watch it like the fourth time and you realize the music is so important in the movie, and then you just start with a cold open, basically. It just starts with him on the phone with a customer service person.
Right.
Which is like, these are the hours of my life that I would least look forward to. Like,
right.
Like, I don't know if you've, I don't know how much time of your life you've actually spent on the phone with customer service people. It's just mind numbing. It's completely worthless time. And he decides to start with one of these conversations, and there's no music. And there's no music for the first 5 minutes of this movie. He's like, he goes out to the street, the piano. When Lena first shows up, there's no music, no music, no music, no music. He brings the harmonium back to his office. And when he finally gets it to work, the music kicks in and kind of doesn't let up from that point on.
Yeah, exactly. Right. I mean, it's and I think that's it's how important music is obvious. But it's when it is decided to come in, and then what it does for the rest. It's like, so it's as if, like, I mean, music has entered his life. That's the idea, I think, to some degree of this, yes, of this relationship. Somebody has come into his life, and so think about the title, right? And what punch drunk means, and combining punch drunk with love. It's like you're loopy, you're disoriented, and that's especially, yeah, for somebody like this Barry Egan character, who doesn't know how other people feel, but he's feeling a way that maybe he, you know, hasn't felt in a long time, or maybe ever. You're on this manic journey with him, and like there's moments where the music is unsettling, but you get used to it. And I think that's the point, yeah, of if you're disturbed is the right word or not, or just,
well, manic is a great word. Manic. So I felt manic when I left this movie for the first time. The music does this, but also the persistent, awkward exchanges.
Well, the sisters are just are cacophonous.
Yeah, I'm gonna play you a scene here.
Remember when Barry used to get all mad?
Oh my god! Ron used to call him Gay Boy all the time.
That's Gay Boy. Oh my god! Remember the sliding glass door?
Oh,
the hammer sliding glass door.
He was mad.
Going to mom and dad's house. Remember him home from the hospital? He locked himself in the bathroom with the hammer.
He's not ready.
Hey, there he is. We used to call you Gay Boy. Remember, you'd be fine, and then we'd call you Gay Boy. You just freak out.
We were calling you Gay, and you got so mad you threw the hammer through the sliding glass door. You remember?
I don't remember that.
Yes, you do. We were calling you Gay Boy, and you got so mad. Are you gay now?
I don't know. I don't
know. We were trying to figure out why you had a hammer in the first place.
Why did he have the hammer?
Wearing that suit?
I don't know.
Why have the hammer?
Thank you.
Are you using that dandruff shampoo I bought you?
Yes.
Barry.
I love the dandruff shampoo. I love it so much. It's like, I was pretty certain I could fix you. And I can't fix you. And so maybe you're just hopeless. You know, it's such a great little throwaway line.
Well, he couldn't even get in the door, right? Like
he can't even get in the door. As soon as he opens the door, he hears his name. He's like, they're talking about me.
They're talking about this story.
They're talking about
an old story.
And so he like wants to close the door, yeah, twice.
Like he doesn't really want to go.
Can I suffer through this? I don't know if I can suffer through this.
Well, and it's such a, it gives a window into like, okay, how much of his problems are really his problems, you know, and not just a byproduct of, you know, or at least just not being understood.
I mean,
right?
Look, here's these sisters, and it seems like they've got a certain rapport, right? It's like they talk to each other in a particular way. It's very blunt. They enjoy talking about situations in the past that might have been awkward at the time, but they kind of, you know, enjoy reliving this with like the benefit of hindsight. And this is sort of like Barry's worst nightmare.
Right.
So how do I relate to these people that enjoy talking this way when I just don't know how to talk this way?
Right. And also, let's be clear, he has been probably somewhat raised by seven women who were very dominant in his life, at least from this little glimpse, infantilize him. Right. I mean, they not only want to tell this story about him as a child acting out, but they think it's funny. And they don't look at that behavior then through like a lens of like, I wonder if maybe he could use some therapy. I wonder if he could, if he'd be better served if we didn't talk about this kind of stuff. And so then he erupts, and it's like, and it's an interesting thing. Cause I've seen this with, and I don't think I'm telling tales out of school, but like my wife has three sisters and they all have their different roles in the family. And when they get together back at like their parents' house, I watch, they all kind of will start to fall into those roles again, right? Like there's just maybe there's something about the familiarity of the home or just the atmosphere of when they get together. It's, you know, so there's this idea that like he gets there and they're all like, you feel like this dynamic was probably always the dynamic. And so the question is, was he really just one more gay boy comment away from breaking windows, or is there some level of like, well, this is what I am here, so I'm going to do that. I mean, there's so many things to sort of unpack about that reaction. And like I said, in another Adam Sandler movie, man, that guy's wild. He's crazy. Like in this one, I'm like, there were so many things to question about his motivation for doing that, whether it was instinctual, whether it was spiteful. It's so hard to know.
Are you using that dandruff shampoo I bought you?
Yeah. Barry. She's got to sneak in. Tell him he's got dandruff in the most passive aggressive way possible.
Well, Heather made a pretty great observation. She thinks that question came up because he had rice on him.
Right. Yeah. Of course, later on, one of his other sisters
picks rice. You have rice on your.
And so it's sort of like the first sister was like,
because it popped up. It popped out of the unbreakable bride and groom plunger.
So this is important.
This is one of our old ones.
And I've sort of developed a little theory about this just this morning. I've been wondering about the seven sisters for a long time because, of course, it's a constellation. And right after the title sequence of this movie, after you get the cold open, you kind of see
the stars, right?
And I've known that there's like a lot of mythologies about the seven sisters in the ancient world. And, you know, it's Paul Thomas Anderson. So it's sort of like, this is not throwaway. This is a detail he thought was interesting. Right. It's probably intentional.
Right.
But I could never figure out what the hell was going on with the symbolism. And I think that there's something related to the plungers that's important. It shows the seven sisters, shows the stars. And then you immediately go to him and he's like in the middle, like he's midstream in his plunger spiel,
which is like, to me, one of the most fascinating moments, because I'm like, there's just no way people are going to like a plunger headquarters for a spiel and an explanation of how you gotta keep them at eye level. You gotta keep them at eye level for the kids.
It's almost like there's a reputation around town. Like, dude, you got to go there. You got to go to the warehouse.
Yeah, once
because
you see
there's
it.
A guy, and he knows more about plungers than anyone on the earth. You have to see this guy talk about plungers.
The wedding plungers, just an amazing idea.
So you get the seven stars image, and he's talking about plungers, and then he starts getting these phone calls from his sisters that are just totally dismissive or outright insulting, or you know, picking up like who says the word chat, like you know, just picking him apart. And he's just like
in the middle of his together job, like he's working.
Yes,
one thing you think that they would be encouraging him to do is continuing to be like a functioning member of society.
No, yeah, they're calling him to make sure he goes to a party where they get to pick at him some more.
Exactly.
So, all right. So you've got the Seven Sisters juxtaposed with the Plungers. In the ancient world, there's like 49 different mythologies about the Seven Sisters. And you get to the Mediterranean and go east, there's like 20 stories that are pretty, you know, they're different, but they have a certain similarity in that they also represent water in a way. Okay. So some in some mythologies, like different bodies of water, like there was one sister that represents rivers and the other represents oceans. And, you know, the other one represents ice. So there's these seven sister stars. There's lots of stories about them. They either represent women or water or both. I don't know if this makes any sense. Okay. Then I find a little detail from the Talmud. The Talmud, which of course is written by Jews, so there's only going to be one deity. There's not going to be, you know, seven female deities up there. But in the Jewish mythology, this constellation was holding back the waters of heaven, and the divine hand removes one of the stars and just displaces one of the stars so much so that the waters from heaven can come down and flood the earth. All right. So I thought, well, maybe this is interesting because this is supposed to be a Jewish family.
Mm-hmm.
If the stars represent both his sisters and the floodgate of heaven, is this movie not about someone who's kind of like emotionally stopped up?
Hmm.
Again, with the water theme, what do you do with the plunger? You unclog something that's water-based. And I think that there's something about these women in his life that kind of created a situation for him where he's emotionally constipated and he needs to figure out some way to like unconstipate himself. And I don't know if the myth, I mean, I could just be that I'm reaching or whatever, but I think that there's something interesting about the plungers as a metaphor for what he does for a living.
Well, yeah, I mean, speaking to, you know, what you said earlier that, you know, Paul Thomas Anderson is rarely unintentional.
Yeah.
And if we grant him that, it's his job, but it's like it's never like referred to comically about the, they don't even mention the plunger, you know, like, which you would think that if you're going to do a, you have an opportunity for any kind of like scatological reference or something, yeah. But it just doesn't, that's not a priority in this.
It's movie. So subtle. You would totally miss it, you know?
Yeah. Like, so it,
you're going to do an Adam Sandler movie. His job is that he's a plunger salesman. Of course you're going to do some scatological humor.
Right. Nope. You're going to have something to do with, and it doesn't. And so that's, I think that might actually reinforce your point that it serves a role, from more of a symbolic standpoint as opposed
I think it's an emotional metaphor for him as an adult. Like he feels deep emotions, right?
Well, and if you really want to go even further, I mean, you could, the idea of the ridiculousness of a wedding plunger, right? So you have a bride and groom on there and it's, you know, that could be kind of an on the nose symbolism of what love is supposed to look like. And he talks about how it's unbreakable and it completely breaks apart, right? On first move. And the question is, was that an old one or is he too strong? Does he have too much rage, right? Does he have too much pent up that he doesn't even know what he's capable of, kind of a thing, right? Because later you see in the background, you see Luis Guzman's character just banging those things in the background and they're fine. So
I was gonna ask you, that's such a good, I'm so glad you mentioned that. Could this be an Incredible Hulk movie?
Like, I mean, yeah, so, like, yeah, that's great. I love
it. Here this guy is, and he's got this rage monster deep inside. This is almost like an episode of The Incredible Hulk, this movie.
There's so many great scenes. Like, I mean, the scene where the brothers hit them in the car, And he just John Wicks. like it's like he's a sleeper cell, right? I mean, of all the things, like of the whole movie of I don't know and fumbling about this, even the way he drinks coffee makes me nervous. And when this moment happens, there is there's no second guessing, there's no hesitation. He's full of rage, but it's unlike, I mean, it's channeled in a way that's, you know, I mean, you know, you don't necessarily have to hit people with a tire iron, but in this particular case where you've gotten, you know, a second assault and you don't know this thing's ever going to end. He has agency, and this rage that sometimes manifests itself into broken sliding glass doors is, at least in this, you know, in so much as it can be, productive. And it's almost dance-like, the way that he goes through the whole thing. Like, it's choreographed, and he does,
yeah.
And it's, but he does it without, there's like, he's almost at his most calm in this movie when he's pummeling these guys with a tire iron. Like, it's an interesting moment where he looks the most peaceful as he's doing it.
I have a question about this. At the very beginning of the movie, he walks outside, he's looking at the street, and he sees a car accident. And then he kind of freaks out by it. It's like, it's not a minor car accident, like a car rolls.
Yeah.
Flips, you know, five times, and then is gone. And then what you see is a van putting the harmonium down on the street and driving away. Do you think the car accident is just him imagining? Like, is that in his head, or is this actually happening?
Well, you see the aftermath of it, I feel like, throughout the movie, like all over the street.
So what is, okay, so you think that it's not just in his head? Because I was thinking, like, for him, it's sort of a metaphor for something's going to jolt him in his life. Like, there's something coming down the road that's going to upend everything and bring him into a new place of his life. And maybe that's how he experiences the harmonium. Maybe the harmonium is actually, like, the thing that's going to change his life forever. But it's possible that it's both. It's like, maybe this accident, and you see his response to the accident, like he's freaking out. But it could be that the accident happens and you see the way he's freaking out, but it also is kind of foreshadowing this climactic moment in the movie when there is an accident and he gets T-boned and then he, like, completely transforms.
Right. Well, because the accident that we were just talking about, where he gets in this car accident, he sees the object of his affection, this woman, is injured by it, and then I get the sense that he responds not out of rage but out of love. And if you look at the initial car accidents, this car flips and it's just like, it's awful, it's got to be terrible. But then he gets distracted because somebody places inexplicable music in front of him, or a music device. Look, there's a lot of rage, there's a lot of violence, there's a lot of tragedy that kind of encompasses his life, or at least his soul. But rather than get him dandruff shampoo, maybe he needs to be surprised a little bit by joy.
Yeah, maybe so. It could be like, you know, like you said, like when he sees the blood running down her forehead, immediately he's protective and he has purpose, right?
Right.
Now I know that my purpose on Earth is to protect this woman. And it just so happens that I have an ocean of rage that I've been nurturing in my soul that now I have a place to put it. Like, there's a use for it now. I'm going to go completely destroy these guys.
Right. I mean, and he, he suddenly wants to put an end to this harassment. And for his own sake, he'll just go to the ATM and try to appeal to, you know, oh, well, it's actually a lot of money for me. And he kind of just sort of just puts up with it. But now it has to end. You know, his you know, kind of naivete has created this problem. And it's like, well, he's just not going to be a victim to it anymore, right? Like, so again, it's sort of like, again, this grasping of agency. And so it goes all the way to Utah with ripped phone out of the wall still in hand.
The problem is, if you give me a chance to explain, one of your employees,
that girl who I was just speaking with, has been threatening me, and four blonde gentlemen just attacked me and smashed my car and hurt my girl.
All right, go fuck yourself. That shit has nothing to do with me. All right, I run a legitimate business here.
Listen to me. What's your name, sir? Answer me!
What's your name, asshole?
I'm Barry Egan!
How do I know? You can be anybody,
you're a bad person. You have no right taking people's confidence in your service. You understand me, sir?
You're sick.
No, no, no. Shut up! Shut the fuck up!
You have no right to take people's
confidence. Shut up! Will you shut up? Shut up! Shut up! Shut up! Now! Are you threatening me, Dick?
Why don't you... You go fuck yourself!
Oi. Fuck! Did you just say, go fuck myself?
Yes, I did.
That wasn't good! You're dead!
So, who are you going to use to match Adam Sandler in a shouting match?
And,
you know, I was thinking, like, there are a few people that could do this. Like, I think Joe Pesci could do this. Philip Seymour Hoffman is the perfect person to have on the other to have on the other line, who you can kind of, like, is this guy okay? Like,
right. Well, that's what really, I love this because what's great about this is that we don't know much about Philip Seymour Hoffman's character. We got a pretty good sense of his ethics, his morality, such as it is.
Yeah.
So we could kind of assume certain things, right? But we go through Barry for most of this movie, and it's really like, I think it took me a couple watches to see the sisters as problematic as Barry, right? Like,
yeah.
And not only problematic, but like also, you guys can't be right. Like, you guys, something's up, I think there's very much a on the spectrum element of a lot of these characters.
Oh, for sure.
And in a lot of ways, it's kind of like, it's kind of a handy little tool to sort of between the music and just sort of the anxiety that, like, you kind of get the sense of like how hard life can be when you're wrestling with certain things. You know, some of it could be nature, some of it could be nurture, probably a mixture of both in these cases. And so we don't know, like, so it's easy to kind of assume that the rest of the world that Barry lives in is got it more together than he does. But I think you find that that's not the case, right? And I think that because even his
the world is mysterious, and sometimes people just kind of act like it's normal, and it just baffles him. Like, when is it okay to lie and not to lie? Because everyone else seems to know this, and I don't.
Right.
Or when is it okay to, like, be playful, and when it's not? Because everyone else seems to know this, and I don't. And the phone conversations with, a company that scammed you out of money, it's like, it's one of these things where, like, I know that this happens in the world. I don't know the right way to act in this situation. I don't know if there is a right way to act in this situation. This is, these kind of phone conversations will absolutely drive you crazy, and you'll hear yourself saying things that you never thought you'd say. And you know, it's sort of a fantasy. It's like, all right, I'm gonna keep this phone in my hand all the way to Utah until I see you in person, and I can stare you down eye to eye and make you agree with me that you were wrong. You know, that's sort of a
right.
It's kind of a fantasy in that
way. Well, and the phone is so amazing to me because two things could be happening, and they might both be happening simultaneously, is he is so focused on this that he can't even think to he can't let go. Right. So it's both both, you know, physically and mentally, he can't let go. And the phone represents a lot of that. Right. I mean, this all comes from the phone conversation.
Right.
And can't let go of this phone until it's resolved. And it does. Right. I mean, he does. He releases the phone at the end when it's over. And
he gives it to the furniture employee or something.
Yeah. Cause it's almost like, okay, I don't need this anymore. Like there was it's representative to a certain degree, right?
Saw that guy in the blue suit walk into the back of your warehouse, and he's holding a phone that still has the wire attached.
That would freak me out.
That this way guy more is than if the guy
had a gun. Like I mean, I'm like,
whoa. Oh, totally. Totally. Yes. This guy's unhinged.
Yeah.
And, for sure he's unhinged.
And so I think it's what I like about, you know, as we get more with this Philip Seymour Hoffman character and the way he's just screaming at him on the phone to shut up.
Will you shut up? Shut up. Shut up.
Well, that's a guy who is used to having control.
Yeah.
And he's losing a little bit of that control because on the other side of the phone is a guy who's learning about agency and he's trying to get some control back. And he's not playing by the rules because he doesn't know what they are or he's resetting them. You know, like it's a really.
Well, he doesn't believe there are rules. Right. He's like, people will just bend to my will. But what if they don't?
Right.
You know, what would happen if someone just sort of matched my tone of voice? I got nothing after that. Well, there's nothing I can
do. And all of his power through this relationship and probably through others is through the phone. And so he's telling him to shut up because he's like, you're on the phone and this is the only thing. I can't hit you. I can't stare you down. But I'm going to use this tool. So it's like there's something kind of powerful about him still having the phone in his hand, which is to say that I'm holding all the power that you have. This is it.
That's right.
This is who you are. You belong in this phone, but you are not you. Like, and it's kind of how with anything, dealing with any, scam or whatever you might be dealing with on the phone. It's like, you can't do anything. And then, so he gets there and he's like, all right, the cord is off the wall. It's just you and me. And I love the stare down is amazing. And it builds to this, just say, that's that. Like, he basically is just saying, look, I'm giving you an out. And, and then Philip Seymour Hoffman plays this so well. And like, I love when they give the stare and he says, that's that. And then like, he still kind of gives this little lunge towards, towards Barry. Right. But Barry just kind of keeps going. And then when he comes out and he wants to get the last word, it was like, oops, because again, it's like the, no, I can't, I'll still, and the thought that was kind of going to be it, right? Like that, but no. And then Barry turns back around. What did I just say? Didn't I warn you?
It's interesting because it's like, he didn't come for his money back. Like, I think most people would be like, I came all this way. You not only are you going to give me my money back, you're going to pay for my car. You're going to pay for my travel expenses. I'm not leaving here until I have satisfaction monetarily. But it's almost more personal than that in this. It's like, you scammed me and made me feel like a victim. And I'm just here to tell you that I'm not a victim.
Right.
And if I can get that out of you, it is worth every penny to put you in your place.
Right, because there are no police officers in this thing. There, he doesn't beat him up. He just basically gives him, he's like, I want you to know that I'm winning this. Or you know, I say it's over. And that's
And he's so honest. He's so honest in this moment. He's like, I have a love in my life, and that makes me more strong than you can imagine.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
I really liked what you were saying before about agency. I think that this, I think it goes back to the discussion about sports talk radio before, because I'm writing a book about masculinity right now, and I won't go into all the technicalities, but in gender studies, we have a term called hegemonic masculinity. That's your kind of quarterback type. And subordinate masculinity. That would be like a fan in the stands who's wearing the jersey of the quarterback.
Mm.
And it could be, you know, pretty pronounced, like Barry Egan, who's just submissive, 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 you know, kind of a beta cut kind of guy. But the subordinate masculine performance does not necessarily need to be effeminate. It could just be like, hey, I like sports, and I'm going to call and talk to the sports talk radio guy. And I think for most of this movie, Barry is like subordinate masculinity. And Philip Seymour Hoffman is absolutely, it's like he's exploding with hegemonic masculinity. Like what happens when he's getting his hair cut and the woman next to him starts to like talk smack to Barry. Like, you're the one that called the sex line. He puts up his finger. And he's just like...
silences her.
Yeah, just silences her.
For no good reason. You know what I mean? Like,
yes.
She is saying what he would agree to.
Yes.
But it's because he doesn't want it to look like someone else has to do his talking for
him. It also especially is kind of a funny scene because he puts up a finger, like, to shush her.
The cape
but is the still fingers... on. Yeah, the fingers under the hair apron.
Yeah.
And it makes that little noise. And so that's kind of funny. But you can kind of see this guy, Philip Seymour Hoffman, has total control over the women in his life and the other men in his life. So he's the alpha male. And Barry Egan.
And Barry can't even get a word in edgewise over the women in his life.
He can't even stand up to his sister who made him use dandruff shampoo. Right?
Totally.
And so you kind of want the roles to reverse. And there's a certain catharsis when the roles reverse. But it doesn't happen. You know, it's not like he brought the tire iron to destroy Philip Seymour Hoffman. He just needed that. He just needed him to say, that's that.
That's that. Say, that's that, mattress man.
I would just say it. If I was you, I would just say it, right? Man, it's just a really interesting analysis of the different kinds of masculine performance.
Well, and I think it is, you know, not lost on the conversation that, you know, he's the idea that they've been calling him gay. You know, I mean, talking about the different, you know, masculinity issues, right? And it's like... And I don't even get a sense that it's he just doesn't know. Like, I mean, it's a fascinating issue that he's having. And then especially when it's like, you're the one boy in a group of women and they treat you like you're still a child.
Every single one of them is over you. Yeah, that's right. And it does sort of remind us like, okay, if you shame someone, there's something about the combination of shame and anger that will precede violence. And that's exactly what happens in the scene. I wanted to ask you about like, okay, so this morning I mentioned to Sarah, just take out all the anxiety. It's kind of a romantic comedy. And she kind of laughed at me, like, it's not a romantic comedy. So I was going to ask you, do you think that this could work as a romantic comedy?
I think it can. And I think it's almost like you get to choose how you want to watch this movie. Like, kind of going back to what we were talking about, like, how with a few tweaks, suddenly this is an Adam Sandler, you know,
yeah,
just funny movie. And so I think you can, if you want to believe, and I think you actually have to make a choice. If you want to believe that the relationship that he's forging is healthy and sustainable, then yes, because it's hard. Most of the time in romantic comedies, there's this, an implied happily ever after. You work through whatever it is you work through, whether it's a misunderstanding, whether it's, you know, getting over whatever issues that are in the way. And then they, you know, the man, the woman come together and it's great. And everything. Oh my God. What? Like, so those, you know, they have a certain, you know, in many cases, romantic comedies are as unrealistic as an action movie because, it requires, you know, some sort of, you know, logical gymnastics.
Suspension of disbelief. Yeah.
And so in a movie like this, because I think the themes are so heavy, I have a very hard time just accepting that they're in love and that it'll work. Because they're both... But then on the flip side, you're like, these people are so weird. Why not? Are they perfect for each other, or are they fine enough for each other? And that's probably what these people need.
So there's a scene where he goes to Hawaii and they connect and they go back to the hotel room. And it's a little bit of pillow talk. And she's like, You're so cute. Your face is so cute. I just want to bite your cheek. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Again, one of these situations, like, people are so weird. Like why is that? If you don't understand like social cues, like how do you know how to respond to something like that? How do you know, like, this is kind of violent and freaky and weird, but in this situation, like, it's kind of adorable. And Barry, who's like always trying to figure out like how to be normal, he just kind of lets himself go. He's like, I just want to smash your face in. It's so pretty. And then she ups the ante. She's like, I'm going to scoop out your eyeballs.
Yeah, exactly.
And eat them. That's how cute you are. So it's almost like he's finally found someone where he's like, if I'm a little bit abnormal, it actually works. I could be my true self with this person and I don't have to feel like someone's gonna ridicule me or call me gay boy or whatever if I say the wrong thing. So I think it works as a, I think it, this could work as a romantic comedy, although it does not feel like a romantic comedy.
Right. I agree. I think it can. And I also think the scene right after is really important where she's on the phone with the sister and lying that she's had any real interaction with him. And to me, that's like the sweetest thing she could do for him, because now it just means that the sister can butt out for a while.
Yeah. The conversation that she's having with Barry with her eyes is completely different than the conversation that she's having with his sister with her voice.
And that scene is important because it shows that it's not, like, oh, well, she's not wanting to talk about that she's in a relationship. It's like, no, she's doing Barry a solid.
No one else in his life is doing this. Like, he goes to Smigel and says, it's kind of funny. Like, he says something like, this is food, when he means this is good. Right. Or no, it's very, he says it's very food.
Yeah, he autocorrects.
And he says... And then his sister kind of ridicules him for it. And I think at that point he's thinking, why did I say that? And then Smigel says, maybe you said that because you're hungry. And immediately he thinks, like, this guy's Freud. this guy must be like Sigmund Freud over here. He nailed it. I'm going to tell him that I need help.
Exactly.
So he goes in and like starts talking to him like he's a psychiatrist. And you think, oh, this is tragic and kind of sweet at the same time, but at least he's reaching out for help. But Smigel totally blows up his spot.
Right. And not only just says that, but it tells exactly everything that happened.
Like, do you cry? And she's saying this right in front of the girl that she's trying to set him up with. Like, why do you have a crying problem, Barry? So finally he's found someone who will be on his side. And if it means lying to a sister... Oh my gosh, this is what he's been wanting his whole life. So I think it is a romantic comedy. I think it's like there's a few obstacles, you know. These two people are probably both damaged. Like the fact that she likes him makes me think, like, what's her deal? In what ways is she broken? They probably need to do some serious emotional work, both of them. But as the movie ends, he's got unlimited sky miles, and she has a job where she travels. What else do you need? The happily ever after. Like that's kind of what romantic comedies ask you to do anyway.
Right.
They're not asking you, like, you know, what are the complications that are going to happen after the relationship? As the movie ends, they both found each other. And I think that's kind of what you want in a romantic comedy.
Yeah, no, I agree. And so I think there is, I mean, I think it's, I mean, in it's a comedy that's more tragedy, and it's romance that's also maybe a product of just other issues. But in that, it all works. And it meets the formula, all that good stuff. But it's so it is. I think it's a matter of choice. I do think you can kind of choose how you want to enjoy this movie.
Is there a trope, a cliche, or a device that you like in this movie?
Well, this may seem strange. I like Smigel being in it.
Sure.
Because it does. So being a Sandler movie, like. You know, instead of it being a movie that Paul Thomas Anderson makes with Adam Sandler in it, by having Smigel in there, it feels like you're in an Adam Sandler movie enough.
I don't think I've ever seen Adam Sandler in a movie where one of his friends wasn't also in the movie.
Right.
That's just kind of who he is and how he works. So it's like Paul Thomas Anderson was like, well, if it's going to be an Adam Sandler movie, we're going to have to bring in someone that has been in an Adam Sandler movie before.
Could we also maybe just I think we should mention something about the use of the Popeye music.
Oh gosh, I missed it.
The She Needs Me from the Popeye the movie.
And all at once I knew he needed me. Until the day I die, I won't know why, I knew he needed me. It could be fantasy, oh.
So I was talking to Heather about that, because it's in a movie where, like you said, there's so much like sort of like just freeform jazz, just to kind of ratchet up the anxiety. That's like the one song, it seems like, for the most part.
It's the needle drop, yeah.
It's clear as day. And what's, I think, why I just really am drawn to it is because it's a song that exists from a movie, right? It's not like, it's one thing to have a song that's also in another movie, but this was a musical, a movie that was a musical. And this song is prominently featured. So I was talking with Heather about it, and just like, you know, what does that do for you? And she's like, well, she's like, it's an, you know, in the movie, in Popeye the movie, you know, it's kind of played as sweet, She's like, but the whole thing is like, she's like, he needs me. I could fix him. Like, it's
interesting.
It's like an ode to codependency, right? And so having that be the song that's kind of their song is pretty great.
Also, he's a little bit Popeye.
Well, right. Well, I think so. So let's go with that too, right? I mean, what's Popeye most known for?
He's fights. He eats spinach, gets super strong, and punches people.
He gets picked on until he makes a change. Yeah. Until he, you know, gets his spinach, uh-huh. You know, and so it's like. They kind of see that, right? He gets his spinach in this movie.
Okay, I like this a lot. I also like the parallel with Robin Williams, who plays Popeye, right? Oh, I think okay. that there's yeah. a I think that there's a parallel here between the comedic actor, the stand-up genius kind of guy who becomes a dramatic actor. And I, in my mind, I think, because I've never really been a big fan of Robin Williams' stand-up, I think he, at the end of the day, he's a better dramatic actor than he was a comedian. And I think that there's something Paul Thomas Anderson is doing with Adam Sandler that's kind of along this lines. Like, he saw something in the Sandy Sandler movies. He's like, no, that's not just goofy. That's not, like, brainless humor. There's something deeper there that can be tapped.
Right. And he can do it. Right. And Adam Sandler can do that because he is doing it in a way that maybe you don't realize. Yeah. I mean, it is because like Sandler doesn't have like Jim Carrey's done that, right? Jim Carrey.
Sure. Sure.
Straight goofballs. But like he's, you know, very content to go full dramatic. And Sandler now has, I think maybe 3-4 under his belt. Right. But he has no problem returning to become Hubie Halloween.
Yeah, no, for sure.
You know,
yeah.
And these are choices, right? He can. I mean, and the thing is that he's probably just likes doing it, but he could for sure do the other. And like, I mean, Hustle's great. I've tried to watch Uncut Gems with Heather, but you talk about anxiety.
Oh, you should finish Uncut Gems. I think you'll love it if you haven't finished it.
No, I haven't. You should definitely do that
for sure. And the other thing I was going to say about this is your Popeye call out. So I was watching an interview with Paul Thomas Anderson. One thing he said was, at times I was frustrated with the making of this movie because I just thought it should have been a cartoon. So there were times when he was just like, ugh, I just want this to be a cartoon. Like, I'm not really interested in animation. But I think that kind of points to the tone he was hoping to go for. And again, it's one of these things like, how do you see the world, man? What is it about your eyeballs that are different than everyone else's eyeballs? So I like that. I did not connect the song with Popeye, but now that you say that, it made me think like, yeah, no, that's a cartoon choice in that way. Anyway, I like that. I couldn't think of a trope, a cliche or device that I like. And this movie's so unique.
Yeah.
I guess the cold open is sort of like it's a little bit reminiscent of SNL, which is sort of, you know, PTA is a big fan of SNL.
The tire iron flip was another one.
Yeah, of course. And, you know, that scene is interesting because he's got to get the tire iron away from the first guy.
Yeah.
Like. And then, you know, he gets it and then flips it thinking like, all right, I got it away. Now I've got to turn it into mine. You know, I've got to show mastery over this device.
Yeah, the flip is, I think, is a because I think that's such a like it does feel like you refer to the superpower thing. This is him getting his spinach. Like, he flips that thing with a level of confidence that it is an unnecessary flair, right?
It's something that you would do with an object that you're very familiar with, and you've done it 100 times.
Right. It's an awkward instrument. It is asymmetrical. So in order to flip it in such a way where you could get it with that much ease, you would have to be familiar with it.
Is there a tweak that you would do to this movie to improve it?
I don't know, man. I'm not going to say it's perfect, but like, I feel the pacing is great. I feel the music is great. None of the actors take me out of it. I think it's funny when it needs to be. I think it's powerful when it needs to be.
It doesn't have a lot of fat. It's like 85 minutes or whatever. It's like, yeah. I think the first time I saw it, I would have really liked the music to be toned down. It really affected me. I was really distracted by the music. And upon rewatch, I'm like, no, you can't. The music is crucial to getting you to feel the way he feels.
It'd be easy to say, I wish there was less times I was uncomfortable in my life, but I don't think this movie works if you're more comfortable.
So I can't think of anything.
I love when Lou absolutely, like, again, like, there's so many Lou value added moments. Like, why are you wearing a suit? And then, like, the next day he comes to work, Louis Guzman.
I was going to say that too. It's so perfect.
But then he's not again. And I love it because it's like, what it shows is that, like, there is this, it's a very subtle nod to the idea that because we're looking through Barry Egan and because we're looking at a guy who doesn't really know how to behave, is like, he might be surrounded by more people that are like him that he realizes.
Or they're trying to figure him out. They're like, okay, clearly this guy.
They think he's mysterious, or they think he's onto something, because he might actually behave to, in their mind, like he's confident.
Luis Guzman's so great. He's trying to make sense of this weird warehouse that he works in.
He just falls in the chair at one point. That's so funny. It is such a funny part of the, because, like, when comedy happens in this movie that's like clearly comedy, it's also kind of jarring.
Because kind of a character actor that people will use like a one-trick pony. I think this movie shows that, like, he's a legitimately interesting actor.
Yeah.
Is this movie better, worse, or on par with a Ron Howard film?
Oh, I think it's a Howard plus six.
Yeah, it's one of these movies where you can't imagine anyone else making it.
No, and I don't think that anybody else would want to.
Maybe the Safdies, you know, because they did kind of do the Uncut Gems. But I do feel like Uncut Gems doesn't happen unless this happens.
Yeah, I think you're right.
So yeah, I agree. What'd you say, Howard plus six?
Yeah.
I'll get on board with that. All right, so where are we going next with this?
So we're taking Philip Seymour Hoffman and we're going to Leap of Faith.
Interesting. Okay. Now, that is a movie that I maybe saw once in the 90s. Like, I don't even remember really much of the plot of this movie.
Yeah, I recently rewatched it. So I'm excited to talk about it with you.
Bacon. Where does bacon get inserted in this movie?
Well, that's a great question. What bacon could fit into that? I was having a hard time trying to figure out.
I was thinking Trains, Planes, and Automobiles bacon.
Because he's fast.
It's like everything's unsaid. It's like they just have a look across the street. Are you going to get that cab or am I going to get that cab?
Yeah, I could, because there is a lot with eyes in this movie and a lot of communication.
Like, all of a sudden, something's a competition you didn't know was going to be a competition. And it's sort of like this social situation where it's like, shit, now all I care about is getting a cab before that guy.
Yeah, I could see that. Yeah. I like that.
I didn't care about that 5 seconds ago, and now it's all I care about.
I like that. That's good.
Is there a half the battle underground moment in this film?
Yeah, if you don't need to get the last word if a guy is holding a phone that he pulled out of a wall from a few states over. Just say that's that.
If he's still holding on that phone, you say that's that and let it be.
Come on!